sweets. Only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bro. Curry falafel.
What's up, Beardos? Welcome to episode 75 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com. And you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we will talk about what we've been eating, discuss the news, dissect the goodbye letter of an infamous activist who rage quit the internet this week, and conclude with an interview with Alex Felsinger, the program director of Better Eating International, a new vegan advocacy organization that launches today.
Exciting stuff, Paul.
A mouthful.
Yes, it is. And let me say, it has been quite a while since we've had a full-blown interview on the show, so it's exciting to get that back into the show, hoping to do more of that in the episodes to come. I think it's a really interesting one. What they are doing with Better Eating International is something really unique and something that I haven't really seen done before, so definitely check out the interview to see what that's all about and how you can actually be a part of it. And we talk about an article that Alex wrote back in October of 2016 about DXE and the effectiveness of their tactics, something that was very well researched, something I've been wanting to get him on the show to talk about ever since. So I finally made that happen. So definitely stick around for that interview. And with that said, Paul.
Yes, Andy.
We announced this a while ago and we said we'd start reminding people, pestering them as we got closer. And I believe this event is about a month away. What is it?
So I will be speaking at the Delaware Action for Animals 9th Annual Veg Fest. Unfortunately, Andy will not be able to make it. But, you know, if you're in the area and you want to come see me talk and you want to hang out and eat some good foods, then definitely check that out. May 13th, about almost exactly a month away from now. So yeah. Come out and listen to me talk, please.
Please. boy. Yeah, I wish I could be there, Paul, but I think it'll be a fun time. We'll post a link to that event in the show notes.
Cool.
And from the corrections department, Paul.
Yes, Andy.
The Bland family is real.
The Bland family is real?
So for anyone that listened to the Carnage episode, we were talking about how like flawlessly this mockumentary mimicked footage from certain eras. And when we were specifically talking about that, we were talking about how they were, it was the section where they were discussing how kind of boring and bland old and like original vegans were. And they showed footage of this family known as the Bland family. And we were like, oh, that, you know, we thought it was real, but it was just too perfect. Well, it turns out it is real. And that it was actual footage, Paul, and the Bland family actually does exist.
Amazing. So, was it like a thing making fun of vegans at the time?
No, I'm guessing it was just actual footage of this person being interviewed.
Huh.
Who came across as kind of bland.
And just happened to have the name Bland, the last name Bland?
Yes. So
interesting.
Thank you to the few people who wrote in to let us know that they are actually a real family.
I hope they're still vegan. And I guess still alive.
Yeah. And apologies for, I guess, kind of making fun of you. Although I guess it was mostly the mockumentary that was making fun of you. But
True.
Anyway, consider that corrected.
All right. Speaking of a mouthful, referencing something I said 3 minutes ago, Andy, what have you been eating?
Paul, I was just at the Texas Veg Fest.
Ooh.
And first of all, ran into some beardos there, and by that I mean they came to the table and made themselves known. So thank you to Gina, Lindsay, Henry, and Kyle for stopping by the table. It was awesome to meet you all. There was some good food at this fest, and Austin is one of my favorite places to eat food in general. At the fest, Kelly's Croutons was two tables down for me, and these are the best croutons I've ever had in my entire life, and I'm saying that without hyperbole whatsoever.
I miss croutons.
You know, yeah, I had this, like, Caesar salad kick for a while. And it had like the just Caesar from Hampton Creek, and it was really good, and some Beyond Meat chicken strips, and the whole thing was great, except it was so hard to find good croutons in a store.
Yeah.
Like the only ones I could find, not very flavorful, very hard, just like not really pleasant to eat. These goddamn croutons, Paul.
These GD croutons.
These GD croutons are, one, they are now made with Miyoko's butter, so they are palm oil free. They're cool. Garlicky and buttery and cheesy, and they are amazing, and it's like impossible to just eat a few of them. They are so delicious.
Huh.
So if you're a crouton fan, seek them out.
Kelly's Croutons.
Yeah. So Austin is a cool town because I feel like every time I come back, I'm usually there once or twice a year. There's always a couple of new vegan spots or places with really good vegan options that have popped up. So I had a long list of places I wanted to try. Among them were a couple places that had really good names. There's an all-vegan hot dog stand called Doggy Style.
Nice.
Their tagline is, "We only do it one way." And and that was cool. They make like homemade hot dogs. I do have to say their french fries, just kind of store-bought crinkle cut.
Mm.
Really need to step up that french fry game.
Step up that fry game.
Yeah. And especially when you have a place like Arlo's in town that's serving delicious tots. This can't compare when you're just trying to do these like bland crinkle cut fries. Everything else is great though.
You know who would like them?
Who?
The Bland family.
Another place I'm just going to mention because they have a great name. They call it Asian bar food. It is called The Great Y'all.
Oh, that's
so,
I like that.
Appreciation
I like that
for
lot.
The name. I got to try them at the fest as well.
Andy, I just got the joke. I just thought it was a funny name, but then I got it.
Anyway, it's a place that I actually want to talk about. A place called Little Nona's. And they are a pizza cart, a little trailer. Austin is all about their food trailers. And they are an all-vegetarian pizza trailer. And they have their own homemade vegan cheese. And it is awesome. I have no idea what it's made from, but it was really good. It was such a nice change of pace from getting a big old blob of Daya sitting on top of your pizza. And they had all vegan meats. They had like a spicy smoky tempeh. They had a seitan sausage. And the most interesting of the three, which I had to get, beetaroni. Can you
I'm assuming it's made
is,
out of
Paul?
Beets.
Yes. It is pepperoni made out of beets.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it was really, it was so good. It was distinctly beets, but distinctly pepperoni-like as well. It was just kind of its own thing. And it was so delicious. And so we got two pies, and one was a bunch of veggies with some of the spicy tempeh. But the other one was just the beetaroni and cheese pizza. And it was really good. It was actually, of all the new places I tried, it was the one that I was the most excited about and the one that I can't wait to try again.
I hope it was called Don't Beat-A-Roni the Bush. Or like Don't Beat-A-Ron the Bush or something like that.
Nope.
That would be good.
Just beetaroni and cheese.
That's interesting though, because like beets, I feel like are so, they have such like a overpowering beet taste.
Yeah, that nice dirt taste.
But that's cool. I'd like to try that sometime.
Yeah, I hope that you can, Paul.
Thank you.
And then the last place I'll mention, Rabbit Food Grocery. I'm pretty sure I've talked about them on the show before. They are an all-vegan grocery spot. They also carry stuff like socks and greeting cards and clothing, some of which happens to be Compassion Company. Huh. So that's certainly nothing that influences my opinion of them, but they are a really fantastic store. They're very community minded. All of the owners are fantastic. The employees were great. I actually walked in there and we had it was two employees I had never met before, had a great conversation about all the food in town. They're recommending new places, telling me specific dishes to get. Very helpful. And it's just, I don't know, you feel good when you're in there. You feel like you're with your people when you're cool. In there at Rabbit Food Grocery. A little treat I picked up was Chocolate Hollows Peanut Butter Log.
Ugh, terrible name. Peanut Butter Log.
You know, like a nice chunky peanut log, Paul?
Oh, gross.
Yeah, it's delicious. It is... a log. It looks like a log. And is filled with like some kind of creamy peanut butter filling. And then it is coated in their trademarked Schmilk chocolate.
Schmilk.
I can't figure out why they call it schmilk. It's just, it's like chocolate
shitty
and cocoa
milk
butter and shitty milk. It's just, they call it schmilk.
What is it made out of?
It's just cocoa butter and chocolate and some vanilla and, like, there's no, like, it's not like they make it with soy milk or something like that.
You know, soy milk.
But I will tell you this, it's so good. They make it in Vermont, so I was surprised but also happy to see it all the way in Austin, Texas. It is really good. Highly recommend anyone picking up pretty much anything from Chocolate Hollow is really good. So pick it up.
Nice. Cool.
Give it
cool,
a taste.
Cool. All right. That sounds delicious, as always.
Yes. All right. Let's move on into the news. Paul, you found an interesting article.
Yeah. This one's coming at you from Veg News. Coming at you, Veg News. Hampton Creek cleared of buyback allegations. So this is a follow-up to something we talked about. Was this all the way last year?
I don't know. I feel like we've really been following the Hampton Creek saga since pretty close to the beginning of the show.
Yeah. So, yeah, Hampton Creek cleared of buyback allegations. And I'll just read. It's a relatively short article. Obviously, we'll post it on thebeardedvegans.com. The vegan company behind eggless Just Mayo is no longer under investigation for buying back its products to bulk up sales. Last week, Hampton Creek CEO Joss Tetrick sent out an email to the company's 140 employees stating that the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Department of Justice have dropped their investigation efforts against the vegan company. The investigation ensued pursuant to an expose published by media outlet Bloomberg last year that alleged that Hampton Creek staffers were instructed to buy its own products, particularly Just Mayo, in stores to inflate sales statistics. So this seems like a good thing, you know. It's like, oh, they're cleared of this. They, I feel like reading from this first little paragraph, it kind of makes it seem like they didn't do it. But then there's this second little sentence or this sentence afterwards that says, at the time, Tetrick explained the practice is routine for food startups and said that he set aside $7,000 for performing quality control operations that would ensure products sold in stores across the country were not affected by varying weather, packaging, and transportation conditions. So I don't know if this is the impression you get, Andy, but it seems like they did it, but it just wasn't as maybe bad or it wasn't as uncommon as kind of like the Bloomberg article was trying to make it seem. Is that the impression that you're getting?
That is the impression that I get. And now that you're throwing that in there, Paul, I'm unsure as to what kind of outro music we're going to have to use for this episode.
But so I thought that was, I mean, I guess it's still good. It's still good that they're not under investigation. So you would hope that that's because they didn't do anything wrong. And it's like Josh Tetrick said, maybe this is just something that companies do, and it could have been, because the article goes on and talks about how, like, you know, the egg industry has been attacking Just Mayo basically from the start, or Hampton Creek, I mean, and Just Mayo. And maybe this was kind of something that went along with that. That was just them trying to stir up bad press about Hampton Creek. But I guess regardless, it seems like hopefully they didn't do anything wrong. So that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, kind of the impression I got from reading several sources about the whole thing was that this is just kind of a routine practice for a lot of businesses.
Was that the impression that you got, Andy?
Yeah, and I never had to knock on wood. So, yeah, no, I mean, yeah, good, glad. I hope they continue to provide delicious products for the world. I'm glad that they can be found at a Walmart in the middle of nowhere, Memphis, West Memphis, Tennessee, because maybe I'm getting some shitty pizza from Papa John's and I need some ranch to make it taste tolerable.
But
and
not
I'm glad that,
that
they make that available to me.
You're not going to get any of that new vegan Domino's pizza?
Ooh, Veg News pranked everyone.
Such a bummer.
Such I mean, a bummer. I saw it. I saw that and I was like, there's no way.
But, yeah, so I feel like there's not too much else to talk about this. I think it's a nice piece of good news, and we usually don't talk about – we usually don't have too much good stuff. So, you know, this is good. They have been cleared of these allegations, and they are no longer under investigation.
All right, there we go. We will keep people abreast of any other developments in the Hampton Creek saga.
Now that we've got the lighthearted stuff out of the way,
let's move on. Dive into it. This is something of a lot of people sent to us that are like, what do you think about this? And I think everyone probably knew what we already thought about this. But I think we're going to talk about it anyway. And so, essentially, Gary Yourofsky, who anyone that's been listening from the beginning knows this is a figure that has been brought up a few times in a couple of episodes, sometimes more prominently than others, recently essentially rage quit the internet / activism in general, with a few little exceptions apparently. And you know, I feel like we've talked enough about him in previous episodes that like we don't need to do this episode to just sit here and like talk shit on Yourofsky. But I, especially since he's leaving, he's gone. It's like, okay, good riddance, you're out of here. But we're going to talk about this because one, he's received a ton of support from this. So there's obviously a lot of people that read his quite long goodbye letter. And we have read it, so you don't have to. They've read his quite long goodbye letter and see nothing to be critical about this. And the whole thing, him as a figure in general, but especially this kind of goodbye letter, is really emblematic of a certain brand of activism, a certain attitude that's really prevalent within, you know, large swaths of the animal rights movement. And so we think it's important that we continue to have this conversation, continue to talk about this, dissect this goodbye letter, and, you know, really kind of get at the heart of what he is saying. And, you know, this whole letter is framed as tag, you're it. Like, essentially, like, hey, it's your turn. All of the people that I have converted, this is his words, the people that I have converted, the activists I have inspired, it's now your turn to take the torch and continue running, because I am totally worn out from this. So, obviously, a lot of people are going to take cues from this goodbye letter. He's an immensely popular activist, and that is why we're talking about it. So,
Before you start, Andy, yes. I have a question. I have a question for you. Do you think he had, like, when he was typing this on his computer, he possibly had like an ESPN tab also open? Because there is a truly stunning amount of sports facts and metaphors just in the first paragraph.
It's entirely possible. It could also point to, you know, how he views himself.
I think the first one, but
we will. Yeah, that's just it. He's like, I need some kind of metaphor. What's on the TV right now? Ah, Kobe Bryant's retiring. Okay. So anyway, so we're going to read from this. We'll read large sections of this letter. We're not going to read the entire thing. Again, it is quite long. But be forewarned, as is sort of part and parcel with any discussion of Yourofsky, there will be some mentions of sexual assault, of rape, and some other, you know, basically anything you could think of that would be, need a trigger warning or content warning. It's probably going to get talked about in here. We're not going to get graphic about anything, but the words are going to come up. So just be warned about that.
All right.
Okay. All right, Paul, let's sink our canine teeth into this one. All right, so the letter starts off. To all the people I've converted and all the activists I've inspired to do more, please continue to enlighten as many people as you possibly can. My tank is completely empty, so I will no longer be online or active in any capacity besides helping students with animal rights projects and answering emails from people who are beginning their vegan journeys. Allow me to explain in the simplest way. Last year, Kobe Bryant, and then in parentheses, NBA, and Peyton Manning, in parentheses, NFL, retired after 18 years. They didn't hang it up because they wanted to. Their worn-out bodies wouldn't let them continue. Unfortunately, after 18 years of face-to-face activism from 96 to 2014, and a brief quote-unquote online stint for the last 2 years, my worn-out mind, which is an integral part of the body, all caps on the V there, won't allow me to continue either. I no longer possess the patience or the precision to teach, so before I end up like Michael Jordan in a Washington Wizards uniform, it's time for me to fly.
I like definitely don't want to critique his like grammar or anything like that. But he did just capitalize random words like to try and emphasize them. but it sometimes seemed like it was the wrong word to emphasize. My worn out mind, which is an integral part of the body.
Yeah. Very, very odd. And so I think actually I want to do an activist burnout episode at some point, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I can certainly emphasize with this part of the paragraph. You know, it takes a toll on you. I know from my much shorter stints doing, you know, activism every day, having these conversations every day, it really does wear on you. And even when you know you're having a really positive effect on people, on the world around you, and you feel like you're getting something accomplished, it does grind you down. So I can certainly empathize with the sentiment in this first paragraph, aside from the fact that I would never compare myself to Kobe Bryant or Peyton Manning.
Or Michael Jordan. Yeah, I think there's like, you know, there's a lot of things that to criticize about Gary Yourofsky, and we will certainly do all those things. But like looking out for his own health, both like physically and mentally, is not something that should be criticized.
Yeah, I think it's wise for all of us out there to recognize when we've hit our limits and when that's going to take a toll on us, when that will prevent us from being effective advocates in the future. In this case, you know, he says, and I guess we'll see what happens. Maybe he'll come out of retirement at some point, but, you know, this is kind of the end of the line for the intense aspect of his advocacy. And so, you know, for most people, I think it's important to recognize where our breaking point is and to not push ourselves so far that we'll never come back again. You know, it's like learning that all those aspects of self-care and taking time for yourself so that you can continue to be a good activist for a long time.
I'm calling it right now. Gary Yourofsky, your reunion in 2 years. He's just doing it to sell the merch.
Yep, at some VFW hall. $30 a ticket.
Yeah.
Anyway, he goes on to talk about all of his accomplishments, talks about his arrests and how ultimately his journey led him to realizing that education was the most effective and powerful tool that he could engage in, and then talks about how many talks he's given to how many students over how many years. So the letter goes on to say, fast forward to 2017, and it's pretty obvious that, quote unquote, the struggle took its toll on me, especially when the majority of the animal rights movement, apologists, pacifists, intersectionalists, is more concerned about offending, quote unquote, oppressed humans instead of demanding an end to their oppressive hypocrisy. If people are willingly participating in the animal holocaust, they've gone from victim to victimizer since they are unequivocally denying animals the same rights of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness that they are demanding / receiving. Their main form of quote-unquote activism is attacking anyone who doesn't worship at the altar of humanity, especially if they refuse to do yoga sun salutes on a beach before exchanging energy hugs with unbathed hippies in a Woodstock-like drum circle gathering of uselessness.
Andy, I want some energy hugs.
I got some for you, Paul. What do you make of this paragraph?
The whole thing is very, like, masturbatory. Like, he's just kind of, like, he's just building himself up the entire time. And like, I could just, like, imagine him writing this and being, like, so stoked on himself, being like, oh, I'm such a great activist. And so it's like there's that whole thing, and then I mean, obviously this the idea that you introduced, that he introduced in this paragraph, that kind of goes on for most of for much of the rest of it, which is like attacking the what he calls majority of the animal rights movement. I'd be happy if that was the case, which is apologists, pacifists, and intersectionalists. He continues to attack that group of people for, or at least maybe not attack, well, I guess maybe attack, but just kind of talk about how they are ruining the animal rights movement. And what's kind of confusing to me, though, is when he says, like, if, well, I don't get, in some of the paragraphs that mention this, he kind of blends when he's talking about just people in the animal rights movement that are, quote, apologists, pacifists, and intersectionists. So I would assume those people are vegan. It kind of blends with him talking about, like, oppressed people that aren't vegan. So in this paragraph, he says, like, the majority of the animal rights movement is more concerned with offending oppressed humans than demanding an end to their oppressive hypocrisy. But isn't a vegan doing the thing that he wants them to do. Do you know, I feel like I'm having a hard time saying a pretty simple idea right here. And that's that he keeps kind of saying that animal people in animal rights movements that also care about other oppressed humans are hypocrites, but I don't really get why they're the hypocrites. Like, I don't agree with, but I at least understand his argument for saying, like, oh, people that are fighting for other oppressed groups that aren't vegan, they're hypocrites. Again, I don't agree with that, but I get what he's saying. But I don't get why he's calling, like, vegans that are also intersectionalists, why they're hypocrites.
Yeah, well, I guess first we should say intersectionalist is not really the preferred nomenclature. It's something that seems to have popped up around when Unnatural Vegan did her video about she called people intersectionalists. And it's like, have they been hanging out together? What's going on there? But yeah, I mean, essentially what I gather from that argument, Paul, is that it's kind of like you shouldn't necessarily spend your time speaking up for other people if those people are oppressing animals.
Oh.
And therefore you're hypocritical because you're defending someone who is oppressing animals.
I got you.
And he mentions at some point, you know, this is for everyone that fights for animal liberation only.
Yeah.
So it seems like if you're not fighting for just the animals, if you're fighting for anybody else who isn't vegan, then you're a hypocrite. And this is something we've talked about on the show a few times, probably many, many, many times before, which is this kind of very childish idea of I'm not going to care about your thing until you care about my thing. And one, that's just like kind of a super privileged way of looking at these things, because for a lot of people, you know, their quote unquote, their thing is like their own humanity, their own right to life, their own right to not be oppressed. And so you're kind of dangling, you know, you saying, I will accept your humanity and fight for you, but only if you care about this thing. And if only you care about animal rights. And it's like, it's super childish. And we've talked about this, I think, especially on our episode, the crossover with Vegan Warrior Princess's Attack podcast, where by caring about all these issues, you free up time and resources of people who are dealing with oppression based off of race or sex or gender or sexuality or whatever it might be. If they don't have to spend time fighting for those things, it frees up time to fight for animals as well. And this is not to say like, well, humans always have to come first or something, but it's like, yeah, obviously if you're out there struggling for your own life every day, to be accepted or like whatever it might be, it's going to be hard to advocate for others. The whole aspect of you got to put on your own air mask before you put on someone else's, like when your flight's going down. It's like you got to take care of yourself before you're able to take care of others. And I guess that also kind of goes back to the whole self-care thing, right? Like you got to make sure that you are taken care of so that you can be the best advocate that you can be. So when Yourofsky says these type of things, or when any activist says these things, you're a hypocrite if you care about people that don't care about animals. It's a really, in my view, narrow-minded, very short-sighted view of what we're trying to accomplish. You know, and by fighting for the struggles of other oppressed people, vegan or not, that gets us closer to the vegan world because it enables all of us to be in a place where we're ourselves are taken care of and we're able to advocate for others at that point.
Very well put, Andy.
Thank you, Paul.
I don't have anything to add to that.
Interestingly, in this whole apology letter, he actually issues some clarifications and corrections. Wouldn't go so far as to really call them apologies, but
No.
But there's a few points, so we're going to go through those points right now. Something that he has been kind of notorious for is saying that, like, if the whole world went vegan, then that would solve racism, sexism, etc., because those are all sort of roots off of the same tree. And I actually just watched an interview of his on some Israeli interview show, and he was putting forth that exact idea. Like, well, if everyone goes vegan, if you teach a child from a young age that a spider deserves their life just as much as a human or a rabbit or a giraffe does, how could they possibly look at someone of a different race and think that they should be discriminated against, etc. So this idea of like, well, if we go for veganism, all the other things will sort themselves out. This is something that we have roundly rejected, as evidenced by plenty of racist and sexist and homophobic and transphobic, etc. vegans, of which I think you could probably put, it seems from his words, Gary's into that category in many instances.
Yeah.
But so the first point he says addresses that, and he says, since humanity thrives on abuse, discrimination, and injustice 24/7, I no longer believe veganism can reduce or eliminate the depraved things we do to each other. He then goes on to list many of the horrible things that we do, including racism, sexism, heterosexism, classism, and endless religious wars, and then says, we are the nastiest, filthiest, deadliest parasitic organisms to ever infect the universe. Fortunately, vegan lifestyles weren't created for us. They exist to reduce and eliminate the depraved things we do to animals and the environment. So fight to end speciesism must continue. So I read that and I was like, oh, okay. I'm glad that you retracted that. I'm glad that you realized that veganism is not necessarily the end-all big cure for everything that ails the planet. What was your impression when you read that?
I mean, I'm almost like, why did he even need to bring that up? Because he doesn't care about those other things, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm always like, why would he even bother to bring this up if he doesn't even really bother to fight for those things anyways, or try to fight against those things?
Yeah, I mean, something that's really consistent with him is his misanthropy.
Yeah.
And it almost just feels like this is another opportunity for him to talk about how horrible humanity is.
Yeah.
And, like, I think one of the things that really appeals to so many people that kind of, you know, worship at the altar of Yourofsky is that he kind of embodies this rage that activists feel about what's going on in the world. And, I mean, I can't say that I don't understand that at all. Like, I think anyone that goes vegan at some point sort of has to reconcile, you know, feeling this kind of endless rage towards humanity in general for the horrible things that we are doing to animals, even just feeling horrible about what you yourself have done to animals in the past. And so I think that is probably one of the biggest appeals of Yourofsky, is that he kind of is the personification of that rage. And humanity is horrible. Humanity is evil. We are the devil. We deserve to be punished horribly for everything that we've done on this planet. And I guess also another thing, since I'm just talking about what appeals about him, I think he just talks with such clarity and authority on the issues that a lot of people do gravitate towards that as well. How much he speaks with authority is actually one of the things that really, really turns me off from him as an activism, even if everything else he said was in line with my views of the world. Someone that has this attitude of, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm the teacher, you lose, fuck you.
I hereby challenge you to top my anti-rape position. Go ahead. I dare you. What? Yeah, thought so. As usual, I win. Checkmate. You lose. Fuck you.
That is like a super turnoff, but
I will say, it's funny that, like, it's funny that he, like, goes out of his way at any point to talk about how much he hates people, and as you mentioned, how he thinks like horrible things should happen to people, especially people that abuse animals. But then he included that seemingly pointless like couple sentences about how he did 8 lectures in one day at a high school, and he says, And what about this startling quote I discovered from a 2003 Toledo Blade newspaper article after I gave 8 lectures in one day, parentheses, most ever, at a rural high school in Ohio. After the class, I had a conversation with a student who killed pigs on his family's property. I later told the reporter, I remember thinking, here I am with Greg the pig farmer, and I don't want anything bad to happen to this guy. And then he just goes on and doesn't like reference that ever at all, or didn't really even have any lead into it. But that is like so against everything that he talks about all the time, is how everyone deserves terrible, terrible things that happen to them.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about that when I read it, but he does, you know, he's notorious for saying, you know, I wish evil things upon evil people. And
except for Greg.
Except for Greg. Good old Greg.
So, yeah, I thought that was kind of weird, that little couple sentences that didn't really have to do with anything else, but kind of seemed to contradict everything that he stands for, which is terribleness.
Just needed you to know that he did the most ever speeches in a day.
Yeah.
He moves on. Point number two. I also said that new vegans should wear out their old cowskin shoe since the damage had already been done. I no longer recommend that because using/wearing animal skin is always obscene, whether the items are old or new. If you discovered that your old shoes were made out of dog skin or Jew skin, you wouldn't create an excuse to ignore those victims. So why create one when cows are the victims? Throw animal skin products in the trash where they belong. How do you feel about that, Paul?
I don't know. I feel like I disagree. I think that personally, I think if you wear things like secondhand, if you like have an old pair of something or other, and then you go vegan, I think it's perfectly okay to wear. I think not everyone can just, you know, go vegan and then in addition to completely changing their lifestyle, also throw out a bunch of their clothes and buy new clothes. So I personally think it's okay. I don't think wearing fur is still okay because I think I've said this before. I feel like that's typically, unless you're in like, I don't know, someplace that's really, really cold, fur is more of like a fashion-y type thing versus leather, which I think I've said before on the podcast. That's just, unfortunately, that's just like what a lot of clothes, specific clothes are made out of, like shoes and belts and stuff. And it's obviously, we are now thankfully able to get like vegan shoes and vegan belts and other vegan leather products, but that's not going to be accessible for everybody. So I don't know. I think I disagree with just kind of throwing out all these products.
Yeah. And I think this is kind of classic Yourofsky in that it isn't taking into account the struggles of other human beings. And I think that, you know, when we put forth that you must throw away your leather goods in the trash as soon as you go vegan, that one, that's going to prevent a lot of people from feeling like they can go vegan because perhaps they can't afford to make those replacements. For me personally, I think the best middle ground between those things is wear out your, you know, your animal skin belt, shoes, whatever it might be. When it's time to purchase a new one, seek out a vegan alternative if at all possible. You know, switch over to a canvas belt and, you know, whatever it is that you have to do. But it's definitely kind of classist to say that, you know, you have to throw these things in the garbage immediately. You know, I get where he's coming from, but I think also it's really ignoring the reality that a lot of people live with. And I think ultimately it makes it seem like veganism is this like really hard to achieve thing for some people. Obviously for many people, it is financially possible for them to throw out the skin of the animal and go buy something new. And I think a better option is to donate it somewhere, but it's ignoring the reality of a lot of people when we put forth that as like a mandate for something you have to do if you want to be vegan.
I also think it's ignoring, and maybe you'll disagree with this, Andy. I feel like it's ignoring the unfortunate reality that we live in a society that is so like animal product heavy and like the idea, like, I don't know, when people say like, oh, well, you wouldn't wear something that was made out of human skin. But like when you make that, I don't know, when you make that argument to non-vegans, a lot of time it's like so ridiculous to them because they've grown up like using animals and that's just kind of like the unfortunate norm versus it's like we wouldn't do that with a human. So I don't know. I think I can have more empathy with someone that chooses to either like buy secondhand or not throw out their old animal products for like clothing and stuff, just because it's like that's like the culture that we live in. And I hope that like kind of shifts over time. But right now it's like, I think I can empathize with people that wouldn't throw out all their stuff, their non-vegan stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Number three?
Number three. And this is like the whopper of the whole thing, the vegan whopper of the whole thing. So, point three. In the Human Rights Hypocrites video, I believe we've talked about this video in the past.
It seems like one that we would have.
I believe this is, he posted two videos, one to address the charges that he was pro-rape and one that he was like racist and anti-human, etc. I'm pretty sure this is the video he's talking about. In the Human Rights Hypocrites video, I said Palestinians were the craziest group of people on the planet. That is not true, and I unequivocally take that back.
All right, Gary, you're starting off strong. Let's keep this going.
All right, all right. The apologist, pacifist, intersectionalist, vegan community is the craziest by far.
Oh, no.
Then it's all the non-vegan, quote-unquote, oppressed humans, blacks, women, LGBT, Palestinians, Jews, Hispanics, etc., and non-vegan human rights activists because they're proudly supporting the rape, baby-stealing, enslavement, and murder of animals, unequivocally denying them the same rights of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness that they're demanding slash receiving. Plus, if these hypocrites ever became vegan, they'd simply morph into the first group of self-righteous, humans first, animals last lunatics. Basically, everyone else is next, with non-apologists, non-pacifists, non-intersectionalist vegans bringing up the rear because we are the least destructive slash hypocritical.
Did he mean to say that white people are the least craziest, white male people are the least craziest? Did he do that on purpose?
Just, I guess so. I mean, he said, and I've heard him say in interviews that, you know, oppressed people are the ones that are like get, specifically he was talking about when he was in Israel, they get the message because they are an oppressed group. So I guess that's why he thinks that they're more hypocritical. It's like they're fighting for rights, but they're denying rights. And I guess like white men have all the rights. So it's the least hypocritical for them to not be vegan because they don't know what it's like. They're not fighting for anything. I guess that's what he's saying.
I think you're giving him too much credit.
I mean, I feel like that's what he's saying.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's basically blaming people that fight for the rights of others on one of the major reasons why he has to quit activism. They're causing his burnout, which I guess good job, everyone out there. We did it.
Keep fighting the good fight.
Yeah, I don't. It's like, where do you even start with this? I mean, first and foremost, putting these groups in as oppressed in quotation marks as if they're not actually oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's beyond insulting. It's quite maddening to see him to do that.
Yeah.
But also in the same letter, he talks about how horrible and oppressive humans are. And he mentions racism and sexism and all of these things in that list of reasons why we're horrible. And now all of a sudden the people that are the victims of those things are quote unquote oppressed.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can't have it both ways. He says, even though I empathize with certain groups when they battle others, LGBTs over straights, blacks over whites, women over men, I no longer care about quote-unquote oppressed humans because they don't care about the animals they endlessly oppress on a daily basis. With this being said, I will not tolerate defamatory charges of racism or supporting rape, see his innocent of rape video, or whatever other slur the apologist, pacifist, intersectionalist, vegan community wants to manufacture.
I'm going to call bullshit on him saying that he empathizes with those groups because many times throughout this, and literally the one that you just read, he says that non-vegans are not allowed to fight those battles and vegans aren't allowed to fight those battles. So what does he mean when he empathizes with them? He's like, yeah, I'm sorry that things are shitty for you. Or as he would put it, things are quote shitty for you, but like, but you're not actually allowed to do anything because that would make you a hypocrite.
Yeah.
So like what is he even, I don't know. I don't get what he even means when he says I empathize with it, because he most certainly does not, because he said many times that we are not allowed to fight for those groups because it's ruining the animal rights movement.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like basically the argument is the only thing you can possibly fight for is animals. If you do anything besides that, you're a hypocrite.
You can either fight for animals or fight for the fact that Gary Yourofsky is not racist.
Yeah.
Because I love how he's like at the end, he's like, I'm not going to let you I'm not going to let you oppress me by telling me that I oppress other people.
And that's like when people are like, well, if you call me a racist, you're the real racist because you're talking about race.
Yeah.
So basically, this is an idea. This is a mindset. This is kind of a framework for vegan activism, animal rights activism that we see perpetuated in many places within many activist circles, not just Gary Yourofsky, which is essentially saying anything other than fighting for animals is not worth fighting. It's hypocritical. And I don't know, like, how do we, aside from, I guess, just talking about it on our podcast, Paul, like, how do we counter this? How do we build the vegan movement that we want to see, or like the anti-oppression movement that we want to see, when we have so much of this mindset so prevalent within this community?
I mean, I think one thing to do is, you know, continue to point out when people are doing this, when to like call out when people are, you know, like exhibiting these oppressive behaviors, because I mean, it was pretty, I was pretty distraught to see, like, when I looked down in the comments, like all of the extreme support that he was getting. And I was like, oh no, it was like, I was being like punched every single time I read a new comment. I was like, oh no, no, no. And I don't know. I was just like, I guess just at the very least, keep pointing out when people are, you know, just in general being shitty like this. And, you know, it's like, I'd rather not promote. It's like, I want a vegan world. I'd rather not have a vegan world that was only great for white men. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. It's a daunting task. I think that it starts with pointing out the fallacy in these arguments. I think we've talked about this many times, but if you're just creating a vegan world for white men and white people in general, that leaves a whole lot of people out of the equation, and therefore you're not going to have that vegan world. If other people are still fighting for their lives and fighting to not be oppressed, it's going to be a hell of a lot harder to have a vegan world. And also, it's just like the right thing to do. You know, like, don't just care about other oppressed groups simply because it means you'll help more animals, which you will. A more inclusive vegan movement is a more effective vegan movement. But, you know, if we're against oppression, we're against all oppression. It's like, I am upset that slaughterhouse workers are treated so horribly and that it's such a horrible industry for them, as much as I am upset that animals are dying in those slaughterhouses. Like, I don't want any of those things to happen. I want the people working in slaughterhouses to be working somewhere else, and I want those animals to not be raised and killed for food, and I mm-hmm. want the people to be working somewhere with much better working conditions, you know. And I don't feel like those things are hypocritical. I don't think that those things don't mesh with each other. I think that they work in perfect harmony with each other.
Yeah. It's just like the idea that you can only promote veganism, the idea that you can only advocate for veganism is ridiculous. And it's like, it's not even that you need to be, I don't know, like, you don't even need to be ridiculously active in advocating for other groups. Just don't be shitty and oppressive to other causes either. It's like, I don't know. I feel like it's pretty easy to not be, to not be shitty. And
yeah,
I mean, what were you gonna say?
Well, I'm going to say, like, I think in these efforts, we're bound to mess up. We're bound to feel uncomfortable. I have certainly messed up and, you know, look back on things. I'm like, ooh, I thought I was doing a good thing there, and it's maybe not the best thing to do. And someone called me on my bullshit. And, like, it's not always easy, but it is always necessary.
Yeah. And I guess even beyond that, just being open to the fact that you will mess up, or you might mess up sometimes, and being okay with that fact, and not kind of just not having your immediate response be to double down on whatever you did, You know, I feel like that's where it kind of starts, is just, you know, just in general, being more open to things that other people have to say, you know, empathy, something that I do not believe Gary Yosky has much of.
Yeah, it seems like he truly feels that he is open to those things, or that he's the pinnacle of rational thought. You know, everything is stripped of emotion, and he's just talking about the most rational thing ever. And, you know, that's something that's really emblematic of the straight white man. And, you know, Paul, we're not the best.
We are not.
We all got a lot of work to do out there. And I would say it's those of us that have the most work to do, you know, should be pulling our weight and doing as much as we can to educate our fellow straight white men. For all y'all listening, you know, we're the ones that need to really step up in these instances.
Mm-hmm. Did you think that, because there was that one part where he's talking about how, like, when he was like giving all his like his like grammar-esque shout outs at the end, when he was saying like, oh, and thanks to this one person who like did a lecture with me in 2015, and I had her do a lecture because I thought a female's voice would win over anyone who thought I was too harsh. Did that kind of seem like he was like exploiting her?
A little bit, especially because he said that women came up to this other person and said they didn't like Yurovsky, but they really liked her. And she's like, I was just saying your words. And it's like, okay. He just like used her as like a puppet.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. That was weird.
And, like, I'm sure it's obviously something that she wanted to do, but, I don't know. It's just like, look how smart I am.
Yeah, definitely. Big ol' ego.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess to wrap it up, we've talked about how hero worship is really detrimental to the vegan community. It feels like he is one of the top three problematic heroes within the movement, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to hold these people, regardless of how many vegans they've claimed to made, how many animals they've claimed to have saved. We still need to hold them to a level of scrutiny that people need to be held to in order to create an inclusive, effective, wide-ranging animal rights movement.
And I think like a common argument would say like, well, if he wasn't as popular, not as many people would be vegan. But I think, you know, it's like if instead of supporting people like him, we can support other people who are not only in line with our veganism, but are in line with other issues as well. It's then those people will be more popular. Those people will have the sorts of opportunities that he had. So it's like, to think that like he's the only person that can get this job done. And it's kind of like, yeah, well, he says some bad things, but like he's doing all this great work for veganism. He's not the only person that can do this. It's like, and I'm not saying like I'm not saying I would be as an effective speaker as he would be, but there are other people who would be just as effective as he would. So it's like, let's bolster up the people that are not only in line with our veganism, but are in line with our other ethics and morals as well.
Yeah. It's not like he's saying something that can't be or hasn't been said by other activists,
mm-hmm.
in much better ways. So let's do our best to promote those activists as well.
Yeah.
and be your own hero.
Oh, Andy, I like that.
Yeah.
Speaking of heroes, Andy had in the midst of this recording had quite the heroic experience. Obviously, it was edited out of the actual episode. But listen past the outro music into the blooper reel, and you will experience what true heroism is. Heroism, I don't know what that word is. You know what I'm trying to say.
This was like maybe the first time a lot of people are realizing that there's a blooper section on
probably
the show,
probably, which is good. Go back and listen to the bloopers of all the other episodes, because they're some of them are golden.
Better than the actual episode.
So yeah, we this is not the end of this episode yet, though. We got a whole interview coming up.
Yes, we do. Before we get to that, of course, we want to know what you think about this whole thing. Have you read The Goodbye? We're not even going to post a link to it in the show notes, but you can find it if you really want to. Let us know what you think of the whole thing. And you can do that by emailing us, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com, or you can just go to thebeardedvegans.com, use the contact page there. And with that said, we will be right back with an interview with a very special guy, Alex Felsinger, who is the program director of Better Eating International. Our guest today is Alex Felsinger, the program director of Better Eating International. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andy.
So before we get into the new organization that you are a part of, I always like to ask people what brought them to where they are today. So how did you go vegan? How did you get involved in social justice? And what eventually brought you to being a part of the nonprofit animal rights world?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. And that really goes back to my high school years, I would say. I became really involved in a lot of different political and social justice activism after listening to a lot of punk music, some of which is more embarrassing than others. Some bands I still listen to, some I don't. That really just sort of gave me a education on the various problems plaguing this planet. And I got into veganism probably early on in college, actually after meeting Michael Weberman, who is the strategic director of Better Eating International, in college. We actually met at the vegetarian section of a school cafeteria at San Francisco State. And I just went up to him and asked, "Hey, are you vegetarian?" And that's how our friendship started. I was only vegetarian at the time, but he was vegan. And he sort of subtly influenced me to become vegan. He never really preached to me or tried to convince me, but about, I'd say 8 or 9 months later, I made the switch to being vegan. And I was at school to become a journalist, but by the time I graduated, journalism basically didn't exist anymore. There weren't really any jobs. Even people who had been journalists for decades were being laid off from newspapers. And I tried my hand at blogging, but I wasn't able to make enough money to really do that. So I really ended up just waiting tables. And this whole time, I had this idea in my head that I wanted to be a voice for different social justice causes as a journalist, including animal rights. So I kind of tried to stay back from becoming an activist because I didn't want to be painted as being biased. And once I realized that I wasn't really going to be able to have a strong voice that I wanted as a journalist, that I would have a stronger voice just by becoming an activist. So I went back to school and got a certificate in nonprofit management and then started working at Farm with Michael.
Right on. And so you have left Farm, you have started Better Eating International. Today, April 12th, is actually the first day that the organization is officially in the public eye. So what is Better Eating International and what are your goals as an organization?
Well, Better Eating International is it's a new nonprofit. We seek to inspire compassion for all animals through inclusive and empowering vegan education. We see our efforts to change how people eat as an important part of a worldwide movement to create a future where animals are valued as unique individuals and no longer exploited for human gain. So that's our official mission statement, really. But our approach, in a nutshell, though, we believe that to shift to a world with where animals are valued as unique individuals, it'll require revolutions in a few different areas. Technology is a big one. So the folks at making the Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat and all the cultured meat research that's happening. And also in institutional practices. So eventually it would be wonderful if we could get rid of agricultural subsidies, for example, but also in our culture, our beliefs, and our behavior. And the latter category, that's where Better Eating International is very uniquely poised to have a major impact.
So you say uniquely poised, and so this is a big question because you come from the world of nonprofits. You know who's out there. You know who's doing what. So why start a new one, and what is it that makes you unique to provide?
That's an interesting question, and we actually considered it for a long time. But there's a few reasons why we decided to actually start our own organization. The first is that we had a vision for a more egalitarian governance structure. And for an organization that has really healthy communication and a sharing of power divided among the board of directors and a leadership team and then the staff. And we actually have it written into our bylaws that the staff, for example, they have a representative on the board. So the staff is able to have a shared vote on the board. And then the board itself oversees the leadership team, and the leadership team oversees the staff. And so really everybody has a voice and everybody has decision-making power. The second reason is really just that this is an incredibly ambitious project. And we knew that we had to bring on people who had specific talents and experiences that aren't necessarily found in other organizations right now. So we found vegan professionals who were already vegan, but weren't working in animal rights, and asked them if they would like to join this effort. So that's how we came up with this team of seven people who all have really unique, strong abilities that they bring to the table. And the third reason we wanted to start fresh is that we felt that an organization that's trying to do education work with the general public needs to be as diverse as the audiences we're trying to reach. And frankly, this movement is way too white. Even as a mixed race but white passing person, I have sometimes felt a little uneasy in a lot of vegan and animal rights spaces, and I want that to change. On a more strategic level, in the same vein, animals don't have a voice of their own. They need everyone on board. Social change isn't going to happen if veganism is viewed as something that's only for wealthy or middle-class white women. The animals need advocates within all communities and social circles in order for the idea of animal rights to spread within them. We can only achieve this if we recognize the underrepresentation in the animal rights community and lift up the voices within those communities that already exist and invest time and money into reaching those communities with meaningful and culturally responsive messaging and creating new and empowered voices to inspire more of a ripple effect. So we need to acknowledge that we're a movement of humans for non-human animals. We need all hands on deck. And we felt that the only way to do that was to live by those ideals as an organization.
So you've been kind of dancing around it a little bit. So what actually is going to be the first big project from Better Eating?
Well, as I mentioned, we formed this organization around the idea that we need to have talented people around to make really great content. And we plan to develop basically a stockpile of hundreds of 30-second animated PSAs that cover various whys and hows of veganism, such as standard practices on farms, discussion about animal sentience, environmental concerns, going towards fast food options, navigating grocery stores, meat and dairy replacements, social situations like talking to loved ones, etc. So we'll have dozens of different versions for each video, making slight changes to each that actually make a world of difference for the intended audience. The videos in the database will kind of act like puzzle pieces that can be strung together to form hundreds of different narratives, with the goal of delivering the most effective one to each person we reach. So we'll be using what they call sequential advertising. So after somebody watches one video, maybe a few hours, maybe a few days later, they'll see our next video, and so on and so on. At the end of each video, we'll also direct them to our website and our Facebook page, where they'll receive further support.
A question about the various types of videos. So this is kind of segmenting the audience. And why do you feel like that is an effective tactic as opposed to having sort of one very clear, consistent vegan message that you just give to absolutely everyone out there?
Well, thanks, Andy. That's a really important question. And what it comes down to is really just acknowledging that different people have different needs. So if you look at somebody who lives in rural Ohio and they have an income of $25,000 a year, and compare them to somebody who lives in Los Angeles and has an income of like $80,000 a year and lives next door to a veggie grill, their experience with veganism is going to be wildly different. So we really want to make sure that when we're creating content, we're able to make it so that anybody feels like veganism can be for them. And so this works in two directions. One, by providing an experience that seems familiar to them. So if we're talking to them about restaurants in their area and foods that seem familiar to them, that's going to be a lot more effective than showing a bunch of products and foods to them that are unfamiliar. So it works in both ways, where it's like we're providing them with information that is familiar, but we're also not providing them with information that's not familiar. So it's going to really just give a much more positive experience and a much more positive feeling about veganism. And actually, Andy, you might have experienced something similar while you were on the 10 Billion Lives Tour. And for anybody who's listening who doesn't know what the 10 Billion Lives Tour is, it was a program at Farm that I co-founded. Basically, we sent people across the country in different vehicles with video equipment to show people a four-minute video about the treatment of animals on farms, and then pay them a dollar for their time and have a conversation with them about everything that they saw. And what happens when you add that conversation element to the experience is that, you know, you're able to address people's specific concerns and their specific needs around veganism. So if you're talking to an athlete and they're concerned about how to get protein, then you'll talk more about protein, but you probably wouldn't talk much about that with somebody who you don't think cares about that. And you'll focus on something else, like maybe environmental concerns. And also on the same tours, we would try to make it so that we had two people going on tour together who had diverse backgrounds or identities so that they could kind of pick and choose who they spoke to after they watched the video based on whether they feel like they would have a bigger influence or not. So if somebody is an athlete, then they should talk to another viewer who is an athlete because they'll be have a lot more in common. And so it's really just about making people feel like they're hearing from their in-group, because there's a lot of research that shows that people are much more prone to listening to people who are in their in-group versus people who they see as outsiders. So with audience segmentation and with the technologies that are available to corporations and politicians, we are able to get information about people online so that we can actually provide them with an experience that is akin to a conversation after watching a video on the 10 Billion Lives Tour.
So all of the videos, I gather, they're all made using animation, even when you're trying to show what's happening to animals in the agricultural system. So I'm wondering if you could explain why you think animation is the best way to do it, and do you ever worry that people will just accuse you of lying or embellishing the truth if you're showing animation instead of the actual footage of what's going on?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, we could always follow up with some live action footage once we have people a little bit more hooked. But while at Farm, we ran into all sorts of trouble getting advertising brokers to display video with like graphic live action, like undercover footage. So we actually circumvented this problem while at Farm by creating a really fantastic animated video called Have We Been Lied To? So kind of like how South Park can get away with the most grotesque things that would not normally be shown on TV in live action, we were able to get away with showing relatively grotesque things happening to animals in pretty great detail without ever getting flagged. And actually, our tests indicated that that animated video was almost as persuasive as the live action one. So we would need to study this more, but we actually have a theory as to why that is. Most people in the U.S., they don't grow up around farmed animals anymore. We're an urbanized society. But they do grow up around cartoons of farmed animals like Porky the Pig and movies like Chicken Run. So we think it's possible that people actually feel more empathy for the animated animals than they do for the live animals in undercover footage. But also, animation allows us to explain ideas like much more clearly and quickly. For example, we can show an animated baby chick having their beak cut off for just a split second, and people understand the problem. But with live action footage, it's pretty unclear and takes a little bit of time to understand. So when we're dealing with just 30-second advertisements, having that really quick illustration of the problem is really important. But also, we're able to quickly and affordably make subtle changes to videos to tailor them for different audiences and increase their impact. And this would be incredibly burdensome and basically near impossible if we had to reshoot live action video every time we wanted to make a new video. So animation just affords us the flexibility to be more effective.
I'm curious, how are you going to determine and measure whether or not this whole approach is effective?
Yeah, that's something we take very seriously. We know that even if we think that a message is really good, it doesn't matter if the intended impact is not positive. So we're going to draw on existing conclusions in literature from different organizations and social sciences and marketing best practices and create a solid foundation of what we believe works. And then we're going to involve the communities that we're trying to reach by forming different focus groups and running our content by them to see how they respond. So the experience will actually improve over time as we're able to create a video, show it to some people, survey them, see how they respond, and then we'll make some slight tweaks to that video and improve it for future viewers. And of course, while the intent to change their diet doesn't necessarily mean that they did change their diet, the video that creates the largest intent to change is nearly guaranteed to be the one that creates the most actual change. So to confirm this, we're also developing metrics that measure months or even years later whether people have actually made those changes. Since we know that self-reporting on these issues is unreliable, we're looking into ways that we can get people to demonstrate measurable changes to how they see animals and to what products they buy. But since these plans are quite expensive and probably a long ways down the line, we're keeping them top secret for now.
All right. Well, we look forward to seeing what those top secret plans actually are. Something that I wanted to ask you about was the name of the organization. So it's called Better Eating International. And, you know, we always kind of worry about making veganism this thing that's solely about food and diet. Do you worry that the name implies too much of a single issue aspect of veganism? Or, like, what is the intent behind the name?
Well, first, let's look at the name itself, Better Eating. The positive association of better is just, it's commonly used in different corporate marketing for decades. Whether it's a restaurant or a grocery store, everything is always better. And it makes people feel good. And that's a really good thing when we're trying to promote something that some people don't really feel good about. And the present progressive tense of eating, it's non-threatening and it's not, there's no commanding tone. So people are much more likely to listen to us. Hopefully these two things will combine and leave viewers with a hopeful and favorable opinion on vegan eating. But in terms of how we're going to bridge the gap from vegan eating to caring about other forms of animal exploitation and kind of adopting an anti-speciesist identity, there's a lot of research that shows that people are actually much more likely to develop such an identity once they adopt a vegan diet. So vegan eating is really a starting point. If you think about it, the vast majority of animal rights activists are vegan, and there's a reason for that. Even organizations that don't necessarily encourage veganism as a primary goal, their activists and supporters are almost always vegan before they get involved. So there is definitely a discussion going on right now about whether veganism makes entry into the movement too challenging, whether it's too big of a barrier, and whether we should focus on anti-speciesism instead of promoting veganism. And I don't really understand how that's expected to work. And actually, there's a good amount of research that indicates that it won't work. Just last year, a neuroscientist named Simon Christopher Tim published an article called Moral Intuition or Moral Disengagement: Cognitive Science Weighs In on the Animal Ethics Debate. And it's a meta-analysis of several different articles that discuss the presence of moral disengagement in how people think about animals. So the author reviews empirical evidence and concludes that there is a vast phenomenon of moral disengagement by meat eaters. He concludes at the end, "What drives the tendency of people who eat meat to diminish the moral standing of animals they eat is not an essential feature of their rational moral system, but rather the desire to escape the feelings of self-condemnation that arises as a result of the act of eating animals." So he's basically saying when people stop eating animals, they're able to consider them as these unique individuals that we want them to see them as. And in a second article that was also published last year called Animal Ethics Profiling of Vegetarians, Vegans, and Meat Eaters, that was published in a journal called AnthroZoos, the authors surveyed vegetarians, vegans, and meat eaters and basically compared their commitment to various ethical stances related to animals. So overall, the trend that they observed was that people who ate fewer types of animals, whether they were meat eaters or vegetarian or vegan, the higher their dedication to animal rights ethics. And they also looked at the amount of time someone had been vegetarian or vegan to see if the commitment increased with time. And interestingly, they found no difference among vegetarians who had been vegetarian for up to 10 years, but saw an increase in vegans the longer they were vegan. So this is one of the reasons that Better Eating will frame our ask by urging people to work toward vegan eating or explore vegan eating rather than asking them to become vegetarian and also rather than asking them to become anti-speciesist. This is a stepping stone to forming an anti-speciesist identity. So essentially, veganism allows the mental clarity to to solidify that identity as being somebody who cares deeply about animals. And we need more of those people. We need people who will be surrogates for animals, who will speak for them and influence others in their social network to care more about animals as well.
So then in that case, do you ever envision a point with Better Eating where you do make that kind of, I guess you would call it like the final ask, or you do kind of give them that push, or do you envision a system where they're kind of handed off to other organizations that are more dedicated towards getting people into anti-speciesist thinking? If there's not someone to give them that final push and you only get them so far, do you think that it's still effective?
First of all, we definitely will incorporate education about other industries that exploit animals other than animal agriculture. We'll probably call that Beyond Better Eating. So once people are basically, you know, clued into the fact that the food that they're eating is a product of animal exploitation, we'll start talking about other products and industries in their lives. But we definitely don't feel like we're alone in this. And we feel like we're definitely part of a much larger movement that is pushing towards society with animal rights. But we also have some pretty interesting plans to collaborate with local grassroots organizations. So we will be passing people off, so to speak, in some ways, using location targeting, which is one of the many ways that we can target people. We'll be able to direct folks to local organizations and basically put them on a path to become part of a vegan community and further solidify their identity as being somebody who cares about animals, who is against all forms of animal exploitation, and prepare them to be a participating member of a vegan community in their local area. We definitely recognize that social change isn't going to happen just from people watching online videos. We're in this together, and we definitely intend to support local efforts and direct people towards those efforts.
So with all of these big plans, I imagine it will require a lot of funding. So how are you getting the funding from this? And is there any way that people who are listening can contribute to your efforts?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. Hey, actually, if you go to bettereating.com, we have a Kickstarter campaign started to get the remaining funding that we need. We were able to raise a good amount of money to kind of get this project off the ground, but we need some more to basically hire the creative team in order to get started making these videos. We're really lucky to have the opportunity for a matching grant. So for whatever money we raise from the Kickstarter, we will actually have that doubled. And our goal is to get just over $97,000, which will get us up to $195,000. With this money, we'll be able to start our video database and create the first approximately 100 videos. But as with all Kickstarters, if we fall short, even by a small amount, we get nothing. And this might seem dramatic, but really we chose this method because we don't want to fool our supporters. This project literally cannot be undertaken half-heartedly. We know that with the combined skills and talents this team brings together that we can make this happen, but we really do need the money to get it off the ground. So I really appreciate it if anybody who has some money, even if it's just $5, just to throw it our way to get this started. So please just go check out bettereating.com, and you can check out our Kickstarter along with a lot of pretty awesome rewards.
So changing gears a little bit, Alex, I have long known you as someone who is very critical and analytical of various approaches within the animal rights movement, within vegan education. And late last year, you wrote an essay that was titled "Direct Action Leading Where? Why We Need More Vegans Before More Aggressive Tactics." So could you explain what this essay is all about and why you felt the need to write it?
Well, first of all, let me say that I actually really admire the activists behind Direct Action Everywhere for their passion and their strong belief in this cause. And you might actually be surprised to learn that I agree with their theories a lot more than people might expect. They believe that social change happens through the influencing power of social networks. But where we disagree is how to maximize that influence. They seem to think that going into different grocery stores and restaurants and other public places and disrupting and agitating people is going to provoke society to change. But a lot of the social network theory and research that I've seen seems to discuss more about how in-groups have such strong influence over their own social network. So to me, this logically means that people should be social butterflies. They should try to have as much influence as possible in as many different social networks as possible. So again, we agree on the basic premise that we need to be spreading ideas. But the evidence I've seen indicates that disruption and aggressive protest only works when there's already a base level of support. So all the historical evidence I've seen them cite seems to discuss different movements that already had strong support. And when I say strong, I mean like, you know, 30%. And for us, we really just have 2% or less, really. You know, the number of vegans who actually strongly care about animal rights is under 2% of the population. So now, with an animal rights protest, when it gets media coverage, the vast majority of critical or skeptical people who are seeing the coverage of that protest don't have a friend or a coworker to have a conversation with them to kind of set them straight and say, no, actually, like, this protest is really important. It's really necessary. And that's kind of what Better Eating is about, is trying to create those people and creating more people who identify as somebody who cares about animals and will strongly defend any effort to push for animal rights. So, I mean, it's entirely possible that 20, 30 years down the line, that the exact same tactics that Direct Action Everywhere is using right now will become very effective. It's just that we need to focus on creating this base level of support before we mobilize. And there's actually a lot of evidence that mobilizing prematurely can have a negative impact. So when people see that, for example, there's only three people standing in a grocery store disrupting at like a meat counter, then that has a dissuading effect. They feel like, oh, this isn't something that I should care about because clearly not very many people care about it. So we need to basically make it seem as though we have more numbers than we have in order to persuade people to join us. And their protests just don't do that. So really the reason I wrote this article is to encourage new vegans and people who are just getting involved in the animal rights movement to consider whether this is something that they want to be involved in. I know that everybody wants to be the most effective activist that they can be. And I saw my essay as really just one part of a conversation about how to do that.
Yeah, I think it's a really fantastic essay. We will, of course, post a link to that and the other articles you mentioned earlier in the show notes so people can check it out. It's quite lengthy, but very well researched. And a few topics that you mentioned in it that I want to hit on a little bit here. You discussed the difference between inherent and earned credibility. So could you explain what that means and how it applies to animal rights advocacy?
Sure. So if we look at what I touched on briefly before and the history of other social justice movements, other movements have been human rights movements with a base level of support consisting of the humans themselves who are looking to overcome some form of oppression. With the animal rights movement, we don't have that. We have animals who are not able to speak or communicate with humans. So we are the base level of support. Like the vegans who firmly believe in animal rights, we are their only base level of support. And that is so much lower than any other movement has had as a starting point. So what I talk about in the essay is the idea that since we are speaking for the animals, we need to project credibility. So inherent credibility would be like a human talking about their own experience. And anybody listening to that human at least can know that that person is talking about their own experience. But when we go and we talk to other people about what animals experience, we need them to trust us that we are being accurate and that we are actually reflecting what animals need. And of course, to a vegan, that might seem obvious. You know, it's like we see an animal screaming and we want them to get out of that situation. But for someone who eats meat because of the moral disengagement that I talked about earlier with you, they're not as likely to look at that video and actually be moved to do something. Since we don't have this inherent credibility to discuss these subjects, we need to do everything we can to project that we are experts. And I just feel that when we put ourselves in situations where we are outnumbered or where we are yelling and sounding more like fanatics than experts, that we're not projecting that level of confidence.
All right, Alex. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. You've already mentioned the website, but let's plug it one more time. And is there any other social media that you would direct people towards, either for yourself as an individual or as the organization?
Sure. Yeah, it's bettereating.com, and that'll direct you towards our Kickstarter. But you could also go to facebook.com/bettereating. And we're also on Instagram at Better Eating International.
All right, perfect. Well, thank you once again, Alex.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. It's been a pleasure.
So we hope you enjoyed that interview. Again, you know, we talked about a lot of controversial stuff maybe on this episode. I don't know. I feel like we talk about controversial stuff on a lot of episodes. But maybe you disagree with us. Maybe you agree with us. We definitely want to know what you think. So feel free to send us an email, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. Check out our Instagram, The Bearded Vegans. Check out our Facebook page, also The Bearded Vegans. And yeah, Andy, what do you got coming up?
Well, in about 2 weeks, I will be at the Andy Veg Fest in Indianapolis. Indiana.
A great place to be.
It was like it was made for me. That is April 29th. April 30th, I'll be at the Michigan Veg Fest in Novi, Michigan. April 30th, I won't be there, but the Compassion Company table will be at the New England Veg Fest in Worcester, Massachusetts. May 6th, I'll be at the Milwaukee Veg Expo in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And also May 6th, Paul, you're going to be at the Baltimore Veg Fest in Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah.
And don't forget May 13th.
Speaking at the Delaware Action for Animals, 9th Annual Veg Fest.
And you can find all those dates, deets, and links.
DDLs.
At CompassionCo.com.
All right. I think that's all that we got for today, Andy.
So, Paul, I read this goodbye a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm no professional editor, but I could think of one thing that would have made this goodbye significantly better, and that is if he ended it with the following 7 words.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off.
I think I can certainly empathize.
Yeah, you got that
I
one
can,
out?
I mean, there's a lot about them. I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty far...
Andy's speaking in tongues over there.
Yourofsky does it to me.
I think it would take me like another 20 minutes to put
Hold
together.
On, there's a cop at my door. Hey there.
What you doing?
I'm recording an interview for a podcast. I just needed a quiet place.
Okay.
But I'll be done in like 10 minutes or so.
Just checking.
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's all right. You have a nice day.
You too.
Where are you?
I'm just in like a random parking lot. But, like, where I am, there's, like, no other cars. It's kind of behind a movie theater, kind of near a medical complex. It kind of ignores that not everyone has the ability to just throw out... Oh, God. Hold what? On. There's a giant spider in my van.
Oh, my God. Oh, I wish the video was on right now.
The other day, I got in my van and there was like a spider web in the van. And I was like, oh, I guess I have to burn this thing and leave forever. But I couldn't find the spider. And the spider just made themselves known. And they're like pretty big. And the only thing I have to catch them in is a half-eaten container of ice cream.
Oh, no! No!
Which is pressed up against the glass. It's okay. I couldn't find my spoon, so I was eating it with my back scratcher.
That is disgusting. That is so disgusting.
And now I have this half container of ice cream pressed up against my windshield with the spider against it, and I hadn't really thought beyond that.
Oh, this is so exciting. This should just be the whole episode.
Yep. Should. Okay.
How big is this spider? Talk us through this, Andy.
It's not that big, but big enough for me to care. Okay.
Whew. The spider has eaten all of the ice cream now.
Okay. Spider is in the ice cream container with the lid on.
Patrons of the church are going to see an adult man leave his car with an ice cream container, open it up, dump out a spider, and then calmly retreat back into his van.
Okay. Spider is gone, safe and sound. Maybe a little bit of ice cream on them. There's a big ice cream stain on my windshield.
Is the ice cream salvageable?
No, hell no.
Not unless you want to eat spider eggs or something.
My God.
Oh, God, that's so funny. I'm so glad that this is all being recorded.